you. And what you do with that information is between you and God. So are you ready for this? Everybody's holding on. You've got your seatbelts fastened. We're gonna take off with this. So, keeping the earth and you whole, Ellen White, is she God's nutritionist or is she the food police? So some of the fascinating information that you're going to find in this PowerPoint can be found in the book God's Nutritionist by Robert Cohen. Now, Robert Cohen is not a Seventh-day Adventist, but Agatha Thrash gave him the book Counsels on Diets and Foods. And he was so impressed with this book that he wrote his own book. And God's Nutritionist is Ellen White. And he's not an Adventist, but he has a website touting Ellen White. He wrote another book I'm forgetting what it's called right now, but he compares Ellen White with famous philosophers down through the ages. In his introduction, he says, all these philosophers, Ellen White shines the brightest, as the brightest star. And he's not even an Adventist. It's really pretty incredible. So I got a lot of the information that I'm sharing with you from his book and also, of course, from other sources. We find in 3 John chapter 1, verse 2, John says, "Behold, I wish above all things that you may prosper and be in health." Isn't that interesting that he says that above all things, he hopes that we be in health, even as your soul prospers. So here we discover from Scripture that it is as important to guard your health as it is to say your prayers. Maybe it's as important to take that daily walk and eat those whole grains and veggies as it is to read your Bible. Ellen White also has quite a bit to say about health and healthy choices. So what is her role when she's speaking about healthy choices? Is it advisor? Is it one voice among many? Is it the food police? Oh-ho. Before we examine some of the principles and specifics that she wrote about in regard to health, let's see what the Adventist Church says about Ellen White's role and what Ellen White herself says concerning the source of her inspiration. In the book Seventh-day Adventists Believe, we read, "As the Lord's messenger, Ellen White's writings are a continuing and authoritative source of truth, which provide for the church comfort, guidance, instruction, and correction." You know, that's from the 28 Beliefs. Describing the source of her inspiration, Ellen White wrote, "I do not write one article in the paper expressing merely my own ideas." You know, when I travel around the world and talk about Ellen White, I find a certain contingency of people who say, "Oh yeah, she's just talking from her 19th century milieu," or "she's just talking her own opinions." She says, "These are what God has opened before me in vision, the precious rays of light shining from the throne." So either we have to say she is what she said she claims to be, which is a messenger of the Lord who received her inspiration from God, or she's a complete imposter. We can't just say, "Oh yeah, she's a good devotional writer. I like Steps to Christ. I like the Desire of Ages. But other than that, you know, she's way out there." We can't say that. It's like C.S. Lewis said about Jesus. Either he is who he is, who he claimed to be, or he is imposter, because he claims to be the I Am, the great Jehovah God. And we can't just say he's a prophet or a good teacher. Either he is who he said he was, or he is an imposter. And it's the same way with Ellen White. As God's messenger, Ellen White always directed her hearers and readers to what? Yes, absolutely, to the Bible. And yet she spoke with decision and authority that was outside of herself. She said, "I speak that which I have seen and which I know to be true. And I implore you not to treat this matter," in other words, her writings, "with your speculation and criticism, but as the voice of God to you." So is Ellen White's counsel primarily negative? It only is negative until we act on the Lord's message. She writes, "As soon as they decided that they would do the works of the words of the Lord, his message of reproof changed to words of encouragement." So I'd like us to consider three principles of hermeneutics, or finding meaning, from Ellen White's dietary counsel. Number one, she says the diet reform should be progressive. Rome wasn't built in a day, and neither are we always called to make drastic changes in our diet without carefully considering how we will obtain adequate nutrition. It doesn't help if you go from eating meat to eating macaroni and cheese and candy bars every day. We do not mark out any precise line to be followed in diet. Ellen White was not the food police, and neither are we, and certainly I am not. I didn't come here tonight to share with you this fabulous information because I want to be your boss or tell you what you ought to eat. This is, as I said, between you and Jesus. By our example, by our personal choices, by our education and prayer, we can suggest a better diet. We can suggest the reasons for it. But let's not make unreasonable demands on others. Ellen White herself said, "I make myself a criterion for no one else." Isn't that cool? I don't know about you, but I have plenty to pray about regarding my own health choices. Certainly, I don't have time to worry about what is in someone else's refrigerator or on their plate at potluck. Further, Ellen White never said that meat eating was a sin. Did you know that? And neither should we. She said, "I advise every Sabbath-keeping canvasser to avoid eating meat, not because it is a sin to eat meat, but because it is not healthful." Christ's first temptation in the wilderness was over the issue of what? Appetite, yes. Just as our first parents were tempted over appetite in Eden. And indeed, Ellen White writes, "The controlling power of appetite will prove the ruin of thousands when, if they had conquered on this point," what point? Appetite. "They would have had moral power to gain the victory over every other temptation of Satan." That's quite a profound statement, isn't it? Now, this week, I should tell you, by the way, that we are starting every night talking about the book of Daniel. Tonight's Daniel 1, because that, you know, that was when he decided he was going to live healthfully because he wanted to have a clear mind to follow God with greater ways. I want to tell you, because some of you will not be here during the week, you will not be here till next weekend. I want to remind you again that next Friday night, we're going to talk about Ellen White and Last Day events. And this is really, really an important presentation. So I encourage you to bring everyone you can for that one. For those of you, I'm saying this particularly for those of you that I won't see for the rest of the week. But every night here, we're going to talk about the book of Daniel. We're going to go through the first six chapters, and we're going to learn together. We're going to discuss, we're going to ask questions, we're going to make comments. It's going to be sort of like a Sabbath school class, especially at the end. So when Daniel was being inundated by non-Christian stimuli, he wanted his mind to be as clear as possible. Today we're on the borders of the heavenly Canaan, and Satan is wanting to inundate us with inducements to engage in body-destroying habits. Yet never in the history of humanity has it been so important to have a clear mind as it is today in 2012. We cannot afford clogged brains and sluggish bodies. God's original owner's manual gives really specific directions for optimum health. We can check it out in Genesis 1:29. God said, "Behold, I've given you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the earth, and every tree that has seed-bearing fruit, it shall be for you for food." Yet even in 2012, with technology and scientific knowledge accelerating at unprecedented rates, researchers and nutritionists present conflicting views. Have you noticed that? About nutrition, about caffeine, about how much protein is adequate, the benefits and liabilities of alcohol, the frequency of meals, and a host of other health-related theories. Everybody is arguing with everybody else. And in the midst of all this hype, all this nutritional hype, we find the largest, longest-living, formally described group in the world. Who would that be? Oh, yes. Adventists who follow the counsel of God's prophetic messenger have been shown by repeated studies in many parts of the world to live 7 to 12 years longer than their non-Adventist neighbors. I was talking with somebody that was standing in line to get on Air Canada to come here. There was a chatty catty lady behind me, and she asked me what I was doing, and I said, "I'm a pastor, and I'm going to speak about God." And she said, what church? And I said, "Seventh-day Adventist." And she said, "Oh, are you a vegetarian?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, I said, "But it's not a requirement to be a Seventh-day Adventist." And she said, "Oh, I'm a vegetarian too." And she says, I have read quite a few studies where Seventh-day Adventists live longer than other groups." And I said, "Yes, as a matter of fact, 7 to 12 years longer. Vegetarian Adventists live longer than non-vegetarian Adventists, and vegan Adventists live longer and are freer from disease than non-vegan Adventists." So tonight, let's have a look at the health messages that God communicated to Ellen White in order that we would enjoy happier, healthier, and longer lives with the added bonus of helping to keep the earth green. Grains, fruits, nuts, and vegetables constitute the diet chosen for us by our Creator. These foods, prepared in as simple and natural a manner as possible, are the most healthful and nourishing. They impart a strength, a power of endurance, and a vigor of intellect that are not afforded by a more complex and stimulating diet. Meat is not essential for health or strength, else the Lord made a mistake when he provided food for Adam and Eve before their fall. All the elements of nutrition are contained in fruits, vegetables, and grains. So how does the vegetarian diet keep us whole? In this presentation, we are going to repeatedly see how medical science today corroborates Ellen White's counsel of over 100 years ago. The American Journal of Clinical Nutrition says that the incidence of lung and colorectal cancer is lower in vegetarians than in non-vegetarians. And incidentally, vegetarians tend to have a lower incidence of hypertension than non-vegetarians. The British Journal of Cancer reports that vegetarians have a reduced risk for cancers of the blood, stomach, and bladder as much as 45% less. Ellen White makes this startling statement. She says, cancers, tumors, and all inflammatory diseases are largely caused by meat eating. From the light God has given me, the prevalence of cancer and tumors is largely due to gross living on dead flesh. So how's this for scientific confirmation of this previous statement? A vegetarian diet can prevent 97% of coronary occlusions. What's a coronary occlusion? A heart attack. Now here's some practical advice. Ellen White wrote, if you can get apples, you are in a good condition as far as fruit is concerned, if you have nothing else. Apples are superior to any fruit. You know, I used to wonder about that. I believed it because, you know, I believe what Ellen White wrote, but I'd never seen any scientific corroboration of that until recently. Doctors Liu and he, they are Cornell University researchers, published a study that was released on the web on May 8, 2007, that identifies a dozen compounds in apple peels that either inhibit or kill cancer cells in laboratory cultures. Isn't that interesting? They wrote, we found that several compounds have potent anti-proliferative activities against human liver, colon, and breast cancer activities of whole apples. So you got to eat the peel with it. I've always liked to peel my apples, so that was bad news for me. Yes? I believe it does. You know, I'm not a nutritionist. I don't really know, but I think you're okay. As far as I know. Additional research, recent researchers have found that quercetin, which is a flavonoid that's abundant in apples, inhibited the growth of colon cancer cells by 43%, lung cancer by as much as 50%, that apples could help lower the blood cholesterol level and even play a role in inhibiting age-related problems, preventing wrinkles, get this, and promoting hair growth due to a compound named procyanidin B2. So I thought that was absolutely awesome. And I've been trying to eat. Apples are not my favorite fruit. I like mangoes. I like those wonderful cherries that we had at lunch today. You know, I like apricots. Apples just don't really do it for me. But since I read this, I really, really been trying to eat an apple every day. So here's a startling food fact. The beef industry has contributed to more American deaths than all the wars of this century, all natural disasters, and all automobile accidents combined. If beef is your idea of real food for real people, you'd better live real close to a real good hospital. And what about the effect of the vegetarian diet on the environment? Consider the impact on the environment of raising animals for food. An animal must be fed roughly 10 pounds of plants to produce 1 pound of meat. Sorry, I should have converted that to kilos. I apologize. Okay. Erosion and nutrient depletion caused by animal feed production and overgrazing by livestock are destroying vast areas of arable land. A meat eater requires 2 to 4 times more farmland than a vegetarian. Thus, the meat industry constantly destroys vital ecosystems, taking away the habitats of myriad species and reducing biodiversity. The vast Amazon rainforest is rapidly being destroyed to make way for ranching and growing animal feed. So, additionally to that, 8 times as much fossil fuel energy is used in the production of animal protein as is used in plant protein production. Fossil fuels are required to manufacture fertilizers and pesticides for animal feed, to operate farming machinery, for transportation, and for irrigation. We are currently, of course, in an oil crisis, as we all know, exacerbated by the meat industry. So, it's significant that it takes a pound of beef takes 3/4 of a gallon of oil to produce. The meat industry contributes significantly to global warming. Methane, a greenhouse gas, is released by bacteria in the ruminants of cattle and in the manure of many farm animals. Forests and grasslands that would absorb high amounts of carbon dioxide are cleared to make way for farmland. Additionally, the enormous fires used to burn down these forests release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. The average North American meat eater is responsible for 1.5 tons more CO2 than someone who eats no meat. The fishing industry also contributes to environmental degradation. Many species are being fished faster than they can reproduce. 15 of the 17 major ocean fisheries are exhausted or overexploited. Many marine food webs are depleted and ocean ecosystems are seriously damaged. About 300,000 whales, dolphins, and porpoises are accidentally killed in fishing nets each year. Pulling bottom trawls across the seafloor devastates habitats, including coral reefs. So what about one of the Earth's most valuable resources, water? It takes 15 times more fresh water to produce 100 grams of beef than 100 grams of cereals. It has been said that it takes less water to produce the food that a vegan needs for a year than to produce a meat eater's food for 1 month. Thus, vegetarianism is not only a response to the inhumane practices of factory farms, it's also a way to conserve natural resources, improve the environment, and benefit human health. So let's return then to the health benefits of vegetarianism. Maybe we will think twice about diving into this delectable looking dish when we read that the liability to take disease is increased tenfold by meat eating. The Environmental Protection Agency warned that over a third of the lakes and nearly a quarter of the rivers in the United States contain high levels of mercury. The pollutant emitted largely by coal-burning power plants seeps into waterways and builds up in fish. Mercury is a neurotoxin that can cause nerve and brain damage in small children and fetuses. And I thought to myself when I read that, if mercury is a neurotoxin that can cause fetal damage and nerve damage in small children, it could hardly be healthy for persons of any age. So are you concerned already about dementia and Alzheimer's? I am. I'm always thinking, oh, if I forget something, do I have Alzheimer's? The matched subjects who ate meat, including poultry and fish, were more than twice as likely to become demented as their vegetarian counterparts. So what does the scientific community say today about the feasibility of vegetarian diets? It is the position of the American Dietetic Association that appropriately planned, that's underlined there, vegetarian diets are healthful, they're nutritionally adequate, and they provide health benefits in the prevention and treatment of certain diseases. Diseases like diabetes. Type 2 diabetes mellitus is less likely to be a cause of death in vegetarians than in non-vegetarians. Vegetarian diets decrease the risk of cancer, according to the World Cancer Research Institute. Eating a diet rich in plant foods in the form of fruits, vegetables, and whole grain cereals probably remains the best option for reducing the risk of colon cancer and for more general health protection. Fruits, grains, nuts, and vegetables prepared as simply as possible promote the best health. Processed foods are never as wholesome as unrefined and unprocessed foods. So if we are vegetarians and we go to McDonald's, what do we eat? What is our favorite? French fries, of course. I'm sorry to put cold water on your parade, but a weekly serving of fries for girls ages 3 to 5 could up their risk of developing breast cancer in later life by 27%. I don't know the whys and wherefores of that. I'm just reading it to you as I found it in the International Journal of Cancer. But isn't the vegetarian missing some important nutritional elements at critical stages of life? Well-planned vegan diets are appropriate for all stages of the life cycle, including during pregnancy and lactation. Appropriately planned vegan and lacto-ovo vegetarian diets satisfy nutrient needs of infants, children, and adolescents and promote normal growth. And don't ever think that you and your family have been meat eaters too long to change your lifestyle. Dr. Benjamin Spock said, when I was 88 years old, I gave up meat entirely and switched to a plant food diet following a slight stroke. During the following months, I not only lost 50 pounds, but gained strength in my legs and picked up stamina. Now, at age 93, I'm on the same plant-based diet, and I still don't eat any meat or dairy products. I either swim, walk, or paddle a canoe daily, and I feel the best I've felt since my heart problems began. Another study showed that patients with moderate to severe rheumatoid arthritis who switched to a low-fat vegan diet can experience significant reductions in rheumatoid arthritis symptoms. And that is certainly true, was certainly true for my parents. My mother passed away 4 years ago at the age of 87. My father is 93, still living. His mother had very severe rheumatoid arthritis, and he was beginning to develop the symptoms of it 20 years ago. He's vegetarian since he was 30. But he switched to a vegan diet, and now he still plays his accordion, plays it in nursing homes, you know, for older people, plays it at church. Milk is not the health food that the advertising industry and dairy lobbyists would have us believe. Certified death rates from coronary heart disease are positively correlated country by country with milk consumption, particularly with that of the non-fat portion of milk. And that's surprising, isn't it? At least 50% of all children in the United States, according to Frank Oskey of the pediatric section of Johns Hopkins Medical School, 50% of all children in the U.S. are allergic to milk, many undiagnosed. Dairy products are the leading cause, he says, of food allergy, often revealed by constipation or diarrhea and fatigue. Many cases of asthma and sinus infections are reported to be relieved and even eliminated by cutting out dairy. Many food allergists advise patients with migraine headaches and other chronic health issues to eliminate cured or aged cheese from their diet completely. Far before persons were aware of the dangers of high-fat cheese on cholesterol and heart disease, Ellen White wrote, cheese should never be introduced into the stomach. Butter is less harmful when eaten on cold bread than when used in cooking, but as a rule, it would be better to dispense with it altogether. Cheese is still more objectionable, and it is wholly unfit for food. So what does the Bible say about health? Well, we're going to come to that in a moment. Let's go to whole grains first. Individuals who eat 3 or more whole grain servings daily have 20 to 40% less heart disease and diabetes risk, and diaabetes risk is also cut 20 to 40%. Whole grain eaters have lower levels of blood pressure, inflammation, LDL, of course, that's the bad cholesterol, and triglycerides. Whole grains also protect against stroke. Did you know that? Certain types of cancer, gum disease, and obesity. Both white pasta and white rice are strong contributors to diabetes and stroke. So choose whole grain pasta, which is available now in most grocery stores, and make brown rice every time. What does the Bible say? Therefore, whether you eat or drink, or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Our primary motivation for making healthy choices is not to live longer, but to bring glory to God. Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, who's in you, whom you have from God, and you're not your own? For you were bought at a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and your spirit, which are God's. Jesus died for us. That's certainly a greater sacrifice than giving up some tasty beverage or treat that our consumer society hoists on us. Now, I invite you to keep an open mind about my next slide. It might blow you away. I'm just giving you a warning. I myself am not the least bit interested in whether you go to Starbucks. And by the way, you can get soy milk, hot chocolate made with soy milk at Starbucks, just FYI. I'm not interested whether your tea is black or whether it's herbal. But God might be. He's looking for women and men who will trust him with every choice of their life. Ellen White says that tea and coffee drinking is a sin. It's an injurious indulgence, which, like other evils, injures the soul. Those who have received instruction regarding the evils of the use of flesh foods, tea and coffee, and rich and unhealthful food preparations, and who are determined to make a covenant with God by sacrifice, so she doesn't say it's going to be easy, will not continue to indulge their appetite for food that they know to be unhealthful. And now there's reason for that unequivocal prohibition of caffeine, which happens to be the drug of choice for Seventh-day Adventists. It's not just God taking away our fun. The American Psychiatric Association says that caffeine-induced disorders may be characterized by panic attack symptoms that resemble primary mental disorders. Now that doesn't mean that everybody's going to need to go to the loony bin because they drink a cup of coffee or have a Coke. But it means that you're more likely to have anxiety attacks if you drink caffeine than if you don't. And the thing that really concerns me is coffee limits the blood flow to the brain, Drinking coffee or other caffeinated beverages impedes the blood flow to the brain enough to affect scans of brain activity. Radiologists at the University of Wisconsin-Madison said caffeine reduces blood flow by nearly one-fourth, that's considerable, in the gray matter of the brain where nerve cells concentrate. Consuming moderate to high amounts of coffee is associated with increased levels of several inflammatory markers. This is a finding that could help explain previous reports linking the beverage to heart disease. Compared with subjects who did not drink coffee, those who consumed more than about a cup of the beverage per day had significantly higher levels of all the inflammatory markers tested. So, caffeine intoxication symptoms. Now, again, I want to stress to you, I'm not here to tell you tonight that if you have a Coke, you're going to have all these things happen to you. You're just more likely to have one or more of these things happen than if you don't drink caffeine. So, caffeine intoxication symptoms include restlessness, nervousness, excitement, flushed face, diuresis or frequent urination, gastrointestinal disturbance, muscle twitching, a rambling flow of thoughts and speech, cardiac arrhythmia, periods of hyperactive behavior, and even psychomotor agitation. Caffeine impairs the brain in seven ways. It tends to produce dependence, so if you try to quit, it'll probably take you at least 3 weeks until you get over that headache. Why? Because it's a drug. So if you really want to quit caffeine, drink lots of water, because you want to flush that drug out of your system. It can cause drug withdrawal reactions. It can cause or worsen psychiatric illnesses. It impairs physical and mental performance. It interferes with sleep. It may influence the risk of other illnesses that in turn exert frontal lobe effects through physical or mental stress. And it may exert effects that impact on spiritual and social dimensions of character. And just to make sure I've rattled everybody's cage tonight, including my own, consider this. Sugar clogs the system. It hinders the working of the living machine. Today, the scientific community finds a strong link between cancer and refined sugar. Women with increased blood sugar levels are at an increased risk of developing pancreatic, skin, womb, and urinary tract cancers, says a Swedish research team who looked at 64,000 people. That's a very significant study. Ellen White says that far too much sugar is ordinarily used in food. Cakes, sweet puddings, pastries, jellies, jams are active causes of indigestion. Now, she wrote this back in 1905, when the annual sugar consumption in the United States was 18 pounds. She said far too much sugar is used. You know how much sugar we eat in the United States today? Oh, think again. Today, the average annual sugar consumption is 65 pounds, and if you add the 79 pounds annual consumption of corn syrup, Americans consume nearly 150 pounds of sugar a year. Ellen White says sugar is not good for the stomach. It causes fermentation, and this clouds the brain and brings peevishness into the disposition. So if you wonder why you're so grumpy and even depressed sometimes, think about your recent sugar intake. Now, I'm not here to tell you that you should never eat a dessert, never have a piece of pie, never have a piece of cake on your birthday. No, but most of us eat way too much sugar. And we can just think about, how could I cut back on this? What are the health effects of sugar-laden pop and soda? A new study of more than 90,000 nurses at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital shows that daily doses of high-calorie, low-nutrition beverages containing sugar or corn syrup can make you fat and dramatically up your chances of developing type 2 diabetes. Researchers found that women who gulped just one serving a day had an 83% greater chance of developing diabetes than those who drank fewer than one a month. Isn't that incredible? They also tended to pack on the pounds, an average of 17 pounds over 8 years. People need to be aware, says so-and-so of Harvard School of Public Health, that sugar-sweetened drinks are not good for you, especially for people who are watching their weight or are concerned about the possibility of diabetes, which should be all of us. Obesity researchers call soda liquid candy and have tied excessive consumption to weight gain, tooth decay, and even brittle bones. A single 12-ounce can contains about 10 teaspoons of sugar, and a third of North American teenage boys drink 3 cans every day. Let those who advocate health reform strive earnestly to make it all that they claim it is. Let them discard everything detrimental to health. Use simple, wholesome food. Fruit is excellent and saves much cooking. Discard those rich pastries, cakes, desserts, and other dishes prepared to tempt the appetite. Eat fewer kinds of food at one meal and eat with thanksgiving. How does sugar affect our children? Children seem to be particularly susceptible to decreased thinking and intellectual function as a result of sugar consumption. Everyone wants their kids to be smart, right? Well, skip the tutoring for your two-year-old and think, how do the contents of my refrigerator affect my child's ability to succeed in school? Large amounts of sugar in the diet have been demonstrated to impair frontal lobe functions in school-age children. Another cause, both of ill health, of inefficiency in labor, is indigestion. It's impossible for the brain to do its best work when the digestive powers are abused. Many eat hurriedly of various kinds of food, which set up a war in the stomach and then confuse the brain. So are you feeling sluggish sometimes and you're struggling with your own personal energy crisis? Well, simplify your food intake. Ellen White says, it's the custom and the order of society to take a small breakfast, but this is not the best way to treat the stomach. At breakfast, the stomach is in a better condition to take care of more food than at the second or third meal of the day. After all, you know, we've gone about 12 hours without eating, so no wonder it's easier to eat then. The habit of eating a sparing breakfast than a large dinner is wrong. Make your breakfast correspond more nearly to the heartiest meal of the day. And let me tell you something, so many people say to me, but I'm not hungry in the morning. Skip supper and you will be hungry in the morning, I guarantee it. Another breakfast plus, people who eat breakfast live longer than people who don't. And people who eat breakfast within 3 hours of getting up enjoy more endorphins, you know, endorphins are happy hormones, than those who skip breakfast. Regularity in eating should be carefully observed. Nothing should be eaten between meals, no confectionery, nuts, fruits, or food of any kind. Irregularities in eating destroy the healthful tone of the digestive organs to the detriment of health and cheerfulness. And when the children come to their table, they do not relish wholesome food. Their appetites crave that which is hurtful for them. You know, one of my dear friends is a pediatrician, and her cousin came with her two small children to stay at her house this summer, and I happened to be visiting at their house when this happened. And the children were quite unmanageable. And my friend is a young adult. She's 25 years younger than I am. And, you know, she said to her cousin, you know, what's going on with your kids? They had a very open relationship, so she could say that without her cousin being angry. And her cousin said, oh, I've just thrown in the towel. I just don't know what to do about them. The kids were 4 and 2. And they went to the store because my friend needed to pick up a couple things. And the cousin bought this big bag of those little peanut butter cups. That's what it was. And my friend Juanita said, so what did you get that for? And she said, oh, I use this to bribe my kids to be good. And Juanita said, tell you what, you're going to stay at my house for 2 weeks. How about you give me that bag? And with your permission, let me help a little bit, you know, with the management of your children. And she said, oh, yeah, please, I'd love it. You know, she said, I'm dying here. And so Juanita took away the bag of candy that she was planning to use to bribe her kids to be good. And she just worked with those kids. And after a week, it took a while. After a week, they actually responded and you know, didn't tear up the house, and you could look them in the eye and have a conversation with them and tell them what the expectations were. And it's just amazing. You know, sometimes we think that we have to use these things in order to help our kids' mind or whatever, but then they come to the table and they're not hungry for wholesome food. After the regular meal is eaten, the stomach should be allowed to rest for 5 hours. Not a particle of food should be introduced into the stomach till the next meal. In this interval, the stomach will perform its work and will then be in a condition to receive more food. In no case should the meals be irregular. If dinner is eaten an hour or two before the usual time, the stomach is unprepared for the new burden, for it is not yet disposed of the food eaten at the previous meal and is not vital force for new work. Thus, the system is overtaxed. Now, lest there be anybody whose toes I have not stepped on yet, let's go to the next slide. Simplifying our diet might mean to leave off spicy and vinegar-based condiments. Condiments so frequently used by those of the world are ruinous to the digestion. The mince pies, the pickles, which should never find a place in the human stomach, will give a miserable quality of food. But I'm sure some of you know that you can make your own pickles and you can make them without vinegar, and they're very tasty. And you can also buy at most health food stores in the States, you can buy something that's called Bubbles Pickles. They're made with dill, and they have no vinegar in them, and they're just extraordinarily yummy. They don't even have lemon juice in them. They're just good. Here's some counsel that could benefit most of us. Overeating has a worse effect upon the system than overworking. The energies of the soul are more effectually prostrated by intemperate eating than by intemperate working. Many are made sick by the indulgence of their appetite. So many varieties are introduced into the stomach that fermentation is the result. This condition brings on acute disease, and death frequently follows. And perhaps most important, what does our high-fat diet do to our brain? Studies show that diets high in fat are a risk factor for not only heart disease, hypertension, and diabetes, but for cognitive decline as well. Trans fat increases inflammation in the brain, which damages the proteins. A diet high in saturated fat, the kind that comes from beef, butter, and milk, impairs memory. Isn't that interesting? Add clouded thinking to the list of damage, such as heart attacks and blindness, that's caused by diabetes. A new study indicates that erratic blood sugar hits the brain and its working memory, which we use to juggle life's everyday tasks, like dialing the phone and talking to somebody in the room at the same time. This can have major impact on everything you do, work and social activities and family life. After studying 141 older people with type 2 diabetes, which is the most common kind, after studying them for 6 months, Ryan and his colleagues found that those with the highest blood sugar levels made the most errors on a number of psychological tests. And you know what I think is most important about this? Not necessarily that we can multitask or even that we can be articulate or not, you know, blur all of our words together. I think the most important thing is that Jesus speaks to us through our brains. So we must not have sluggish brains in these last days on earth. Okay, we've talked about a whole host of things tonight, diet-related issues. So what is the bottom line? Jesus wants you to be alive. He wants you to be energetic. He wants you to be happy and free from disease. I have come that they might have life and that they may have it more abundantly. And he wants you to have a clear mind so you can hear his voice in these chaotic times. The most precious words may be heard and not appreciated because the mind is confused by an improper diet. Why do you spend money for what is not bread and your wages for what does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me and eat what is good. The spirit, the self-control, the dependence on Jesus that possessed Daniel and his friends. And I hope between tonight and tomorrow night we're going to go into Daniel 2, but I hope sometime in the next 24 hours that you go home and read that story of Daniel 1. It's so amazing. That dependence on Jesus that possessed Daniel and his friends, you may have today as you draw from the source of their strength, Jesus Christ. Never in the history of humanity has a high-sugar, high-fat diet been so enticing and so easy to acquire than in our present Western culture. But Jesus says, look up higher. God wants to reveal through you the results of healthy choices, energy, freedom from a disease, an alert mind, and a mind that's responsive to the things of the Spirit. And that good health will make us a light to our communities. It is our Creator God who says, I have come that they may have life, and that they may have it more abundantly. Several times in the last 3 years, U.S. News and World Report has published online and in print an article on longevity that includes the headline, Live Like a Seventh-day Adventist. Have you seen that? Probably not, because you live in Canada. This is what the article goes on to say. Americans who define themselves as Seventh-day Adventists have an average life expectancy of 89, which is about a decade longer than average Americans. One of the basic tenets of their religion is that it's important to cherish the body that's on loan from God, which means no smoking, alcohol abuse, or overindulging in sweets. Don't we wish that we all did that? Followers typically stick to a vegetarian diet. Actually, that's not true. Only about 40% of Seventh-day Adventists are vegetarian, but that's what they thought. Followers typically stick to a vegetarian diet based on fruits, vegetables, beans, and nuts and get plenty of exercise. They're also very focused on family and community. That's a challenge to us, isn't it? How many of us today really live like a Seventh-day Adventist? Jesus gave his life so that we could have life. What higher motivation is there for making healthy choices? My prayer for all of us is that we would have life and that we would have it more abundantly and that we would appreciate the price that was paid for us and respond with grateful obedience. Now, you know, it's really late, and I'm really hoping that tomorrow night we can start on time and end earlier so that we can have this discussion that I really want us to have night by night. But this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to pass out the discussion questions, and I know that some of you have to go, and it's not going to hurt my feelings at all if you have to go. I see that some of you have small children, and some of you just need to get your rest, and that's fine. But if some of you want to stay and get into a small group and talk about use these discussion questions, and you can make up your own. You can talk about any response that you want to make. You're very welcome to do that tonight. Would you pass these out for me on this side, and then maybe somebody can pass these out on this side. While you're passing these out, does anybody want to ask any questions about health-related things? Yes. Right, right. I think it's right, absolutely. Well, I think if you're half converted on any subject, that ultimately you're going to walk away from the church. So I think she's saying that, you know, if your stomach is more important to you than your healthy choices, then when it comes right down to the crunch and the times of the end, then it's very likely that you're not going to stand up at. Because what is Satan's first temptation? To Adam and Eve, it was appetite. To Christ in the garden, to Christ in the desert, it was appetite. So, you know, that's really a big thing for him. So I think he's going to come down with great wrath at the end of time and use that as a means to get people to give up their faith in Jesus. And he's going to use a lot of other means, too. But I want to emphasize the fact that what we eat is not our religion. It's just our response to grace. So, you know, I don't want you to go away from here and say that I said that, you know, you're going to be lost if you're not a vegetarian. I'm only saying that there are some things that we can do to make our mind more clear and to respond more positively to the work of the Spirit in our lives. And according to Genesis 1:29, the original diet was fruits, grains, nuts, and vegetables. And the closer we can get back to the Eden experience, I think the healthier that we will be and the closer we will be to God. Yes?
Just wondering about microwaves. Do they destroy the value of food?
Some people do believe that they do. I haven't been converted on that yet. I still use my microwave. But I have friends that absolutely will not use a microwave for two reasons. They think it destroys the value of the food, and they also think that the microwave radiation is dangerous and could cause cancer. I have not been convinced of that yet in the research that I have done, but I'm totally supportive of persons who feel that they do not want to use microwaves. Yes? You know, that's the conclusion that I've come to, but, you know, I don't want to criticize anybody who feels that they want to cook on the stove. I see. Mm-hmm. I think we're probably, you know, not quite agree on this. There are persons who are very convicted of that, and there are other persons who are not. And I have nothing to force on anyone regarding that. Well, I have nothing to force on anyone regarding any of what we've said tonight. Yes?
I have been reading a book called Eat to Live by Dr. Furman.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
It's just, mm-hmm. It's amazing. And this mm-hmm. book by non-Adventist, and there's lots of people, it's called vegetarian. His big thing is that you need to be looking at the micronutrients in food and not even to the, you know, the extent of much of what we should be eating, how many foods, and, you know, the box of foods.
Yeah.
Compared to the low amount of, you know, the starchy foods, which is totally different than what our dietary guidelines say. It's mm-hmm. amazing. Fascinated by how close it is to what, and he does mention the evidence of
Yeah. Well, you all know about the blue zone and how there's four areas of the world that have persons who live longer than other people live. And one of them, of course, is the Loma Linda area, which has received a lot of publicity in the last 18 months. Yes. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I'm not offended at all. You can't offend me. Right. Right.
However, if it is progressive, and we know that we sometimes more regularly will have better weight loss when they're just as healthy as a vegetarian.
When she says,
whole grain, severe fiber packed meals. I did that, I lost 30 pounds in 3.5 weeks.
Yeah. You know, I'm not here to argue with you at all. If that's been your experience and you feel that this is something that God has blessed you with, I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have any arguments to make. I only have my own testimony to give, and that is when I have followed the counsel that Ellen White gives, I have felt healthier and more energetic and freer from disease. And when I've gone other routes, I have not had the same degree of energy.